Today in our travel journal or travel history, we're going to visit Damascus. There was a young man who felt called to enter the monastery and to become a monk. And after completing his indoctrination and his training and taking his vows as a monk, the abbot of the monastery appointed him to the scriptorium. Now, the scriptorium is a place where for centuries monks had diligently copied by hand the sacred biblical texts and also the ancient rules of that particular monastic order. Well, the young man was actually quite excited about his appointment, but became very unsettled on his first day. Upon arriving at the scriptorium, he immediately saw that the monks copied the manuscripts not from the originals, but from older copies. The young man took it upon himself to address this important matter with the abbot, stating that copies of copies meant that an error could have crept into the manuscripts and been replicated for centuries without anybody even noticing. The abbot pondered this and realized that the young man was right. So, taking a newly finished copy of the scriptures, the order of their monastery, the abbot went alone down to the lower catacombs to roll out an original and compare the two documents. The abbot was gone for several hours, and the other monks started to get worried. So they sent the new monk down to check on their beloved leader. And upon entering the vault where the ancient texts were kept, the young man found the abbot banging his head against the wall, repeating the same phrase over and over again. They forgot the R. Well, the young man or young monk managed to calm the abbot down and queried, "Why are you so upset?" The abbot exclaimed that indeed there was an error in the ancient texts, and that important letter had been left out in each copy since then. It was the letter R. "Well, why is this so upsetting?" asked the new monk. "Because, my son, the word they left the R out of was celebrate." Well, groaner, yeah, that's right. This little story, whether it's funny or not, I don't know, just goes to show you that if you are determined to live by the letter or the law or the rules, then you better be sure that you have the correct version of the rules, right? Don Posterski, in his book, Enemies of Smiling Faces, tremendous read, makes a very profound and important observation. For a person or society or church to be healthy, happy, a vibrant place, there needs to be equilibrium, a balance, if you will, between conviction and compassion. Posterski goes on to write, "Without compassion, we are people who become harsh and judgmental. In society, conviction without compassion produces social policies that press too hard on problem people." Remember years ago, Thatcher economics? That was conviction and not compassion. A lot of conservative economics are like that. Compassion without conviction, on the other hand, leads to a system that actually rewards deceit. It fosters behavior that lacks honor. And left unchecked by each other, conviction and compassion become social and religious villains, he says. Now, on our stop today through the early church, it demonstrates to us very clearly the validity and the need for balance. Without this balance of conviction and compassion, the church diminishes its value to society and it becomes marked more by fear than by love. Today's passage marks one of the most critical stories in the early church's history. We meet for the second time a man named Saul of Tarsus. Now, I say second time because Saul was present earlier when Stephen was martyred. Saul was a very well-educated, he was a well-connected Jewish Pharisee. As he describes himself, he was a man who was zealous for the faith of his fathers. In other words, the traditions of his faith. Paul was also a man not content to sit on the sidelines while the people of the way continued to preach and win all kinds of converts. Now, again, I remind you, like I spoke last week, that at this point in the history of the church is essentially Jewish. And Saul saw this new church of Jesus as an affront to his religion. And so he undertakes, with the blessing of his superiors, the persecution of Christ's followers, mostly at the beginning in the city of Jerusalem. Saul and his minions terrorized the church with threats of jail, and even executions were not out of the question. Saul was clearly a man fully motivated by conviction. He firmly believed that he was right and the Christians were wrong. And if the Christians did not renounce Jesus and return to the traditions of the Jewish faith, they had to be eliminated. Now, I need to tell you something very important. Saul may have been feared greatly by the Christians, but he was greatly admired by his Jewish peers. The Jewish court, the Sanhedrin, saw him as their champion. To accomplish his goal of eradicating the Christians, Saul was given a tremendous amount of latitude to do whatever he wanted. The Roman authorities, you might wonder about them, actually turned a blind eye to Saul's activities because they saw it as an internal Jewish religious matter. In order to placate the Jews, the Romans often left the Jewish court to handle those religious matters. Jesus before Pilate was that probably one of the rare or few exceptions because Jesus was popular and there were political overtones to his coming to Jerusalem. It wasn't actually until Gentile converts began coming to the faith in large numbers that the Romans actually paid attention and started their own persecution. Now, an interesting thing, maybe it's even an ironic thing, is that Saul's angry persecution of the church actually helped to spread the gospel. To avoid the terror of Saul and his supporters, Christians began to migrate away from the city of Jerusalem and go to new communities, and these new communities began to spring up, new locations of the church. Saul's persecution actually made the early church grow. News of the migration infuriated Saul, and he decided to eradicate all Christians, no matter where they were. So he goes to the Jewish court, or the high priest actually, and he asks for letters of permission to go to the synagogues in the city of Damascus and to hunt down the Christians and bring them back to Jerusalem in chains. Now remember, as I said, Saul was a man of conviction. He was sure he was doing God's work and hunting down the people of the way or Christians. So Paul sets out. And as he's on his way, we have this beautiful story of his conversion experience on the road to Damascus. One of the most important stories in the history of the church. By the way, some people like to say that he was knocked off his high horse. The Bible doesn't say anything about a horse. Saul likely was walking when it happened. Blinded by the light, we're told, Saul has to be led by hand to the city of Damascus, where we meet our second significant person, one of those Christians that Saul was trying to hunt down. Ananias was simply minding his own business when Jesus comes and speaks to him in a vision. And Jesus asks Ananias to go to the now blind Saul and lay hands on him so he can see again. Ananias isn't too sure, is he? He's frightened by this. He's heard everything there is to know about this man called Saul from Tarsus. Maybe Saul, when he got there, Saul would arrest him or worse. Then Jesus explains to Ananias that Saul has been chosen to spread the good news of Christ to the Gentiles as well as the people of Israel. And even though he's terrified, Ananias is obedient and goes and he prays over Saul, and the blindness is cured. Saul's conviction in that moment is now counterbalanced with compassion. The compassion of Christ extended through Ananias. There must be a balance. And if there isn't, God may intervene as he did with Saul. The lessons of Acts 9 for the church are plentiful, but here are just a few for us to ponder today. Although Saul was Jewish in his convictions, he had plenty of counterparts in religions of all kinds, including Christendom. In all religions, there are people who use their conviction as an excuse to harm others. This is certainly true with groups like ISIS, the Taliban in Afghanistan, Boko Haram in Africa, who believe it is their mission in life to kill anyone who refuses to adopt their particular brand of Islam. In Christian circles, we have events like the Inquisition, don't we? But even today, there are preachers and churches that bully people into believing what they personally believe. Whether by violence or trickery, coercion is just that, isn't it? It's coercion. Blind faith like that demonstrated by Saul that resorts to violence is never Jesus' way. Never. Christ is all about building bridges between people, developing abundant living. Anything else is a violation of his love. Saul also demonstrated that just because we think we're doing God's work does not mean we truly are. Being sincere and having conviction doesn't make it right. Just as a person could be quite sincere and have the conviction that they're a turnip, doesn't mean it's right. It likely means there's something wrong with them, right? For the rest of us, there needs to be an ongoing testing of our methods and motives whenever we invoke the name of Jesus. We can certainly pray, we can study the scriptures, but we can also test our convictions in dialogue with each other. One of the things that seems fairly clear is that even with official sanction, Saul was a lone wolf. It's a beautiful thing that after his conversion, he undertakes his missionary work always with a companion. He has Barnabas for a while. He eventually has Timothy. Saul's experience also indicates that just because we seem to be enjoying some success, either in numerical growth or even in miraculous events, does not mean that Jesus is behind it. Nor does being popular mean we're doing the right thing. You know, Saul was a popular guy. People, it says, honored him by laying their cloaks at his feet when they stoned Stephen. Popularity does not equal truth. Another lesson we learn from this passage is that sometimes God uses adversity to accomplish a greater goal. In Acts chapter 9, the persecution of the early church actually brought great dividends to the church. Because people of the way were scattered out from Jerusalem into nearby cities. Sometimes it takes something very dramatic to get us to move somewhere or to get on to some project. And then there's the whole matter of asking, whom do you serve? Saul was very zealous for the faith of his fathers, but he was blind to the truth. In his ambition, Saul began to serve the institution, namely the Sanhedrin or the Jewish court, and not God. Our allegiance needs to be to God. Certainly God calls us into his fellowship, into the body of Christ, but we need to continually remind ourselves that the institution of the church is not always the same thing as the body. Sometimes the institution gets in the way of the true purpose of our being together. Preserving history and tradition was what fueled Saul's rage. The misguided overvaluing of tradition was what ultimately led to the Protestant Revolution, or Reformation, excuse me. The institution of the church had become so corrupt that the message of the gospel was left or lost in the midst of tradition. Like you, or like Saul, we might not want to ask ourselves from time to time, what exactly am I zealous about? Why are certain things of greater value to me than other things? Is my grip on habit and tradition a help or a hindrance? And finally, the message I most want us to remember from Damascus and what Ananias demonstrated is that sometimes God calls us to do something very courageous. God can call us to step away, way, way out of our comfort zone. As with Ananias, we may be called to go to the one person we would rather never see. We may be called to speak up when we would rather just stay silent. We may be called to forego the one earthly thing that we believe gives us security and rely more fully on God. As Ananias discovered, most of the early Christians who followed, walking in Jesus' way can be dangerous. Being Christ's disciples is a risky proposition. It demands our all. It may even, like for Saul, demand a relinquishing of everything we've ever known to embrace the new way. For Ananias and Saul and countless other saints, the abundance of Christ's life in us comes down not to comfort or security or material gain, but it's a matter of faith. Chuck Swindoll, in his book, Living Above the Level of Mediocrity, tells a story, it's fictitious, about a man who was lost in the desert. He was just dying for a drink of water. That's all he needed. And as he wandered through the desert, he happened to stumble upon an old shack, a ramshackled, windowless, roofless, weather-beaten old shack. He looked about the place and found a little shade from the scorching sun. And as he glanced around, he noticed that there was a pump about 15 feet away inside that shack, a rusty old water pump. He stumbled over to it and grabbed the handle and began to pump up and down, nothing came. And disappointed, he staggered back to a shaded spot. He then noticed to the side an old jug. He looked at it, he wiped away the dust, and he read a message attached to it that said, "You have to prime the pump with the water in this jug, my friend." And then it said, "Be sure to fill up the jug again when you leave." The man popped the cork out and the jug, and sure enough, it was full of water. And suddenly he's faced with a decision, isn't he? If he drank the water, he would live. But if he poured all the water down into the rusty pump, maybe it would yield some cool, refreshing water from down deep in the well. Maybe all the water he could ever want. He contemplated his options for a long while. What should he do? Pour it into the old pump and take a chance on fresh, cool water, or drink the contents of the jug and ignore the message? Should he waste all the water? on the hope of those flimsy instructions written by someone long ago. Reluctantly, he decided to pour the water down the pump. Then he grabbed the handle and he began to pump. Squeak, 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 squeak. And nothing came out. Squeak, squeak, squeak. And finally, a little bit began to dribble out. And then a full stream of cool, fresh water gushed out of that pump. To his relief, he was able to drink all he wanted. He even was able to wash his face a little bit. So he drank jug after jug from it. And then he filled up the jug one more time. And he took that note that was on the jug and wrote on the bottom, "Believe me, it works. You have to give it away before you can get anything back." The church has and still is being built by Christ through the lives of men and women who have given everything to gain much back. In closing, I came across a beautiful little poem written by John R. Rice entitled, "I Met the Master." This is what he penned. "I had walked life's path with an easy tread. I had followed where comfort and pleasure led. And then by chance in a quiet place, I met the master face to face. With station and rank and wealth for soul, with thought for body and none for soul, I had entered to win this life's mad race when I met my master face to face. I met him and knew him and blushed to see that his eye full of sorrow was fixed on me. And I faltered and fell at his feet that day while my castles vanished and melted away. Melted and vanished, and in their place I saw not else but my master's face. And I cried aloud, 'Oh, make me meek to follow the marks of thy wounded feet.' My thought is now for the souls of men. I have lost my life to find it again. Ever since alone in that holy place, my master and I stood face to face." Have you met the master on your own road to Damascus? Perhaps it's time you did.